Welcome to Windy City Sports Talk, Chicagoland's number one podcast for all the latest news and in-depth analysis for the Bears, Bulls, Blackhawks, Cubs, and White Sox. This podcast features exclusive news and expert analysis from well-known Chicago sports reporters and broadcasters. You will also feel the passion and emotions during conversations with other diehard sports fans. Other unique sports topics such as virtual reality and video games are explored as well. It's now time to talk Windy City Sports. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Windy City Sports Talk. This is the start of a little series I want to try out, and that is having well-known members of Chicago's media landscape on the show to talk about some of their adventures in the industry and, of course, get their thoughts on some of the biggest storylines in Chicago sports. And my first guest in this little series is the legendary George Offman. George started out as an independent reporter after graduating from Southern Illinois, filing reports for outlets like NPR and CBC Radio. And he's among the original voices of Entercom Sports Talk, WSCR, 670, also known as The Score. And for the last 10 years, he spent time at WBBM News Radio as sports anchor and reporter. And I myself have had the honor of knowing and working for George the last couple of months on his podcast, Tell Me a Story I Don't Know, which features entertaining interviews with top sports personalities, all with connections to Chicago. And I've had a lot of fun working for him and also listening to each podcast too. He's a great interviewer and has great discussions with a lot of the names you're going to know. And you could check that podcast out too. 5-star reviews across the board, especially on Apple Podcasts. A couple of the guests he has out now is including Eddie Olczyk and Michael Wilbon, just to name a few. And he has more coming out every week. So without further ado, George, thank you so much for coming on my podcast today. I'm excited to have you on.
My pleasure, Will. And thank you for all the work that you do. It's like a lifesaver. I'll call Will going, what do I do next? I got to mix this. And Will goes, no problem. Don't worry. Just send it to me and I'll mix it. And he does. And people like yourself. And then you recommended Tatiana T.T. Schenken, who came up with our promo page. And she did a fabulous job. First time, one time, and she got it right, which was great. And then T.J. Reeves, who happens to be the pre- and post-game host for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, how lucky can you be there, is the guy who sends it all out and makes it happen on the other end. So it's been a village. It's been a lot of fun. I can tell you it's a lot of fun. Just before we did this, I finished interviewing Rick Tellender, who I've known forever, and he's an extraordinary figure. People don't know this. They read him in the Chicago Sun-Times, but just remember, he was a star football player at Northwestern in the late 60s and early 70s. He goes back a long way with great history.
Oh, yeah, and he definitely knows what he's talking about. And again, another well-known member here in the Chicago media landscape. Now, George, it's funny, again, working with you and communicating with you with your podcast for the last couple of months since you got it going. The one thing I haven't asked you, and I guess it's perfect time to ask you now for people listening so they could hear about it too, but where did you get this idea to, one, not only do a podcast, but also do this theme of interviewing people with these connections to Chicago and just the way you're formatting your style of a podcast? Because we know there's tons of podcasts all over the place now.
There are. We talked about podcasting at BBM for a while. I didn't particularly have this idea. And then suddenly I got the plug pulled in July, COVID reasons. And so I was one of those who lost his job. Well, here I was, 66 and a half and not done yet. And in my 47th year of doing this, and it didn't take me more than 2 weeks before I started the process of learning podcasting, which is not easy. There's so much to learn. I must have made more than 24 phone calls to people in this country and north of the border to learn about what they did, learn about trying to sell it, talk to some very big names in the industry. And in the meantime, the idea was I had made a lot of connections over the years with many people and a lot of national people, such as Bob Costas and Marv Albert and Kevin Harlan and Charlie Steiner and et cetera, et cetera. And I said to myself, if I can come up with a concept to do an interview with them, as long as they have some grab to the city of Chicago, some connection, this might work. Well, I started the interview process in late September with Eddie Olczyk, and then with Mark Giangreco, who is the sports anchor at Channel 7. And I've known Mark since he walked into the door here in 1982. Well, they were fabulous interviews. Eddie might still be the best. He's just sensational. And of course, I've known Eddie since he put on a Hawks jersey back in 1984. Well, I had a list of names, probably 75 long, and I kept adding to those. And as I was learning and learning and learning, and I realized, oh, you haven't learned nearly enough. The idea was to put it out in mid-November. It was about then that I really started to come up with things I didn't know. TJ came into the picture in October. You came into the picture, I think, in sometime in late October, November. TT came right after that. And I learned, you know, you need to have a promo page, because podcasts are like books and record albums, which are back in vogue. People see a picture and they gravitate to it. It's almost like a bottle of wine as well. You see, you know, what it looks like, and you immediately start to want to learn more. Well, I realized that if you have a good promo page, that might help. I think we have a pretty good promo page. And then I realized, well, I need somebody to clean up my editing, because I'm okay at editing, but I need somebody to do all the other stuff. Thanks to Dan Levy, who knows everybody, he said, I got a guy. That guy is Will Hatzell. I said, okay. And here comes Will Hatzell. And so the three of you are part of this team. And then I had to go out and see, could I get some advertising? Well, I did. And I was very lucky in doing that. And finally, we had a date, January 12th. And our first guest was going to be Michael Wilbon, who I have described as being one of the sweetest human beings I've ever met. And oh, he happens to be a great journalist. I've known Michael for 40 years. And, you know, I did the interview with him, I don't know when it was, in November. And so we finally waited, because January 12th, well, if the Bears made the playoffs, which they did, that next week they might be changing personnel, like maybe firing a few people. Let's wait. January 19th, well, the next day is the inauguration. And guess what? There's a lot of crap going on in Washington. Let's delay again. And so it was January 26th, which happened to be the 35th anniversary of the Bears Super Bowl win. And then we debuted with Michael Wilbon. And he was sensational. Bob Costas was great. I mean, I worked for Bob Costas 40 years ago when he was with the Sporting News. And Bob has great connections to the city of Chicago. He's got great connections to the history of the city of Chicago. His first Super Bowl was Super Bowl 20 with the Bears. Did 19 Bulls games in 1979 and 80 before he took the job at NBC. Famous for doing the Sandberg game. Famous for being part of The Last Dance. So all these people, and, you know, and then there are locals like Chuck Swirsky, who we're going to have on in a couple of weeks. Len Casper, who's running as we speak right now. I just talked to Peggy Kaczynski, who has a wonderful history here in the city of Chicago. And so I find them to be fascinating. And it's, Will, once you open the faucet, and you can tell right now, the faucet's open, I'm flowing, I'm just talking. Well, that's what they do. And they're wonderful in telling these stories. As long as you guide them into a certain area, they will tell you marvelous stories. And thus far, they have. They are the real hit for Tell Me a Story I Don't Know.
Yeah, George, and me having a little bit of insider information here because of working with you, even though you've had the, you know, push off the debut because of, you know, current events and things going on. You've been working hard even in between. You know, you weren't just waiting around to get the podcast going. You've made new intros and outros and interludes and sponsorships. So, I mean, you've worked really hard to get it to where it's at. And I'm really excited to see that it's out there. And like I said, and for anybody listening that wants to check it out, you know, the TuneIn app, Apple Podcasts, I mean, 5-star ratings across the board. I like to check the ratings and the reviews. I mean, you're getting nothing but, great praise, great reviews, and even on social media when you're sharing them and resharing the posts, there's definitely a lot of good things to say about the podcast. And I even enjoy listening to them, not just you know, sitting there mixing and editing a little bit. I've been listening to them. Of course, I like to hear the finished product to make sure I'm doing a good job for you.
Hope so.
But yeah, but also, I mean, really, it's just a very entertaining podcast where it's not that you're doing anything crazy or out of the ordinary, but the way you interview and the way you get to people. And that's something I wanted to ask too. I guess maybe it's a little bit of a personal question for me as I try to grow in this industry too. But I think it's always very important for anybody, especially in our industry, that does interviewing, whether it's as a reporter or as a podcast. But what do you think is an important aspect, besides, of course, knowing information about who you're interviewing, you know, doing your homework and getting background information on them? But what do you think is an important trait of an interviewer that people may not know or talk about? Because again, especially you, 47 years of doing this, you know, doing this business, you know what you're doing. Is there anything that you've learned over the years that's important in terms of doing this podcast and interviewing that maybe people don't talk about or know enough about when we talk about interviewing?
I think one of the important aspects of interviewing is making it simple. Sometimes the simple questions are the best questions. The best word I've ever used in any interview is why. And the reason that I'll use that, and not particularly in these podcasts, is because it puts the interviewee in a position to answer your question. So if your follow-up is why, well, that person's got to answer you some way or somehow, unless they're a politician. Then they don't have to answer anything.
True.
Then they'll ignore the hell out of you. But I think that, you know, that's part of it. Part of it's feeling comfortable. And the other part of it, which I think was really important for me, is I've never been a stargazer. And I wasn't a stargazer from day one when I went to SIU. And we had a chance to interview, I believe it was Daryl Dawkins, playing some exhibition game. And I just looked at him and he was just a regular guy. Same thing with Dr. J. Julius Erving. When I interviewed him in 1979 at the Chicago Stadium, I looked at him and he said, I have a job to do. So I never stargazed at anybody that I was interviewing. And that's really important, because if you get uptight or nervous interviewing somebody of stature, then you won't be able to do it. And luckily here, we've had quite a few stars come our way, from Walter Payton to Michael Jordan to Frank Thomas and Patrick Kane and what have you, et cetera. So I think it's really important, first of all, know your stuff. That's what you got to do. You have to know what you're talking about before you do any kind of interviews. And particularly in a long form interview that we're doing right now with Tell Me a Story, there's a lot of homework to be done. And I will ask the subjects, send me some stories you want me to tell, because, you know, you can read all you want, but there may not be things you know. And so that's part of the trick there, is to have them feed you some information that you may not know. But a lot of reading, a lot of listening, that will help you do better at being a good interviewer.
Yeah. And again, after working and listening to your podcast, you definitely do a good job of that, because, you know, while I feel like I know a lot about, say, Eddie Olczyk, I mean, there's quite a few things, quite a few stories that he tells in your podcast that I didn't really know. I mean, especially, I guess you could say, you know, his hockey career. And for anybody that's your younger audience like me, you know, it wasn't even around when, you know, Eddie played. You know, I know Eddie Olczyk from being the commentator, the
broadcaster,
the games. Yeah, I know him as the broadcaster. So
it's different, Will. It is different, particularly for you. You know, and these podcasts aren't aimed at anybody in particular. Anybody can listen to it. Certainly somebody of your age isn't going to know that much about Eddie Olczyk, the guy before he was the broadcaster, because you didn't see him play. You do know, you've heard of Bob Costas, but a guy like Mike Greenberg is more of a contemporary of yours. Even though Mike is now in his 50s, he is more of a contemporary. But, you know, even Michael Wilbon is somebody that people will know if they ever watch Pardon the Interruption. So that makes them contemporaries. But yes, these people with a lot of history, well, that's for younger people of your age, people in their 30s, they get to learn something that they didn't know. Not just the story they didn't know, but a lot of stuff about these people, which I find fascinating. And for people who are older, that might be in their 50s or 60s or 70s, it's a chance to hear and reminisce about some stories that they have and stories they never heard before from people that they have known and followed for years and years and years.
Yeah, and that is exactly why I am also a listener to your podcast as well. And that's why even back when we were in the early days of this quarantine and this pandemic, when The Last Dance came out, I was in love with that because I hear all these stories from my parents and other family members and friends that are older that were, you know, around to remember the 90s and that fantastic run. And also Dan Levy pointed out too, when he was telling me about like, hey, let me connect you with George. He's like, George was, you could see George technically in The Last Dance, which I believe is true, right? Like I forgot who was getting interviewed, but I know you were there with.
I got a second and a half.
Yeah. You got a second and a half of fame.
I got a second and a half. And I think it was episode 5 because I was on channel 11 with Mike Mulligan. I know who the other guy is right now. I'm looking at him. I just can't remember his name. And it handed me my nephew who said, did you see yourself on The Last Dance? Well, I didn't because I probably blinked. So I looked back and I looked back and I looked back and I said, wait a minute, that's me. And what did I do? I put it on social media. I thought it was hilarious. That is true. Believe me, there were a lot of people in our industry today who covered that were looking for themselves. They were all looking, hey, was I in that shot? Well, I was one of those people. And I said, I don't think I made that shot, but I did make that one. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, there were quite a few people from the media that are, you know, in different places and different positions today that were featured in that. I was just like, wow, it's like, it seemed like everybody at some point found a way to cover, be a part of the coverage of that dynasty and that Bulls era in the 90s. I'm kind of jealous in some ways. I wish I was not born in 1996, but maybe, 10, 15 years earlier, because I would have loved to. Yeah. The best Bulls basketball I saw was, the days of Derrick Rose. And right. Unfortunately, that got cut pretty short, quicker before we thought it was going to. And we thought, a championship with Rose and the guys they had. So I'm still looking for that. But and speaking of that, you being, around for covering that and just, again, for the many years you spent covering sports in Chicago, do you have any – is there a season or a team, and something tells me I know the answer to this, but was there one season or a particular team that you enjoyed covering and following the most?
You'll be surprised to hear that the one that I enjoyed the most was probably the 85 Blackhawks, maybe 86. They had a really, really exciting team playing in the old Chicago Stadium, which is much smaller than the United Center and very loud. And we were not sitting, all that far from the ice. We were above the first level behind the net, which is really the best way to watch a hockey game, is from that angle. And they had a terrific team. They had Dennis Savard and Steve Larmer and Al Secord and Doug Wilson and Bob Murray and et cetera, et cetera. Had it not been for Wayne Gretzky, the Hawks would have won a couple of Stanley Cups with that team, but they just couldn't get by the Edmonton Oilers. They were that good. And it was just so much fun going to the Chicago Stadium to see them. In 1992, we had the fortune of going to the Chicago Stadium to see two championship series taking place at the same time, the Bulls and the Blackhawks. They were in the Stanley Cup Finals. They got wiped out by Pittsburgh 4-0. And the Bulls were playing, I believe that would have been, so this is 92, that would have been, who was that, Seattle? It was the Lakers first. I think that was Seattle. I can't remember. And, it's like every other night you're going to the Chicago Stadium to watch a championship game. only one was the Blackhawks and one was the Bulls. And that was tremendous fun to do that. I mean, covering Jordan, it's so funny to talk to somebody who never really saw him play, but it was a joy to be sitting courtside for almost all of those home games and to watch this marvelous athlete display his talents. And, you know, the same holding true for Scottie Pippen and the supporting cast. When Michael first came here, nobody really knew him very well. He used to shop at my brother's clothing store. And it was very funny because, you know, I would walk in and there was Michael, who was a clothes horse even when he came out of North Carolina. And I would just look at him going, "Hi, Michael," and would walk away and let him do his thing. He eventually signed on with someone else. My brother tried to get him to sign on. Too bad he couldn't do it. And then eventually it got to the point where, you know, Michael had his entourage and what have you. But it was still, you know, great to interview him. He would take on, there would be three waves of reporters, not one, not two, three waves, because that's how many people were in the locker room. And I would always be smart enough, because I was little, to kind of squeeze right in, get into the first wave, get my microphone up and ask my questions, because otherwise you were in big trouble if you didn't. So I would say that the Blackhawks of 85, the Bulls teams, and probably the best event that I saw was the Cubs in 2003. When they won their series in Atlanta, it was the first time they won a playoff series since 1945. And it's game five. I'd already gone to games one and two in Atlanta, and of course, three and four at Wrigley Field. And now it's Yom Kippur. It's the highest holy holiday of the Jewish calendar. And my boss is looking at me going, "Do you want to go?" And I said, "Are you crazy? Of course I'm going to go." And I went. And it was the largest crowd in Braves history. Boston Braves, Milwaukee Braves, Atlanta Braves, 54,000 people. I guarantee you, Will, much more than half were Cubs fans. I'd say well over 30,000 fans there were Cubs fans. They made extraordinary noise. And what I remember afterwards is watching Kerry Wood spray fans with champagne. I can't get that out of my head. That was such an amazing experience to be part of that first playoff victory they had in how many years, from 1945 to 2003. So there are a lot of events, but teams from excitement level, the Blackhawks that year, they were so much fun to watch.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about, you know, the Blackhawks of the 80s and early 90s, because, you know, we're going to always celebrate, you know, Taze and Kane and whatnot, but people forget. And again, even myself, you know, as I try to remember the history of one of the team when I wasn't around yet or watching that, you know, they had some pretty good players that unfortunately didn't get to win a cup or multiple cups. And of course, you know, hockey's GOAT, you know, Wayne Gretzky definitely played a huge part in that, unfortunately. But now, in terms of your interactions with, you know, interviewing or covering players, coaches, other sports personalities, is there any people that stand out in terms of that you remember the most and had some of your more memorable interactions with?
Sure. Best interviews were by far Pete Rose, Tony Gwynn, Dave Winfield. These people love to talk. Love to talk, and they knew it too. They knew you loved hearing them talk. Pete Rose is amazing because he was so statistically analytical, and he never turned down an interview. And it didn't matter what the subject matter, didn't have to be about the team he was on, but some other subject of the game of baseball. Remarkably, of course, I'm one of those in the camp that says he should never be in the Hall of Fame for what he did, and I remain that way. But as far as interviewing, those three guys come to mind immediately as being so incredibly affable and fun. I used to poke at Reggie Jackson to get him to talk. And when he did, he was really good because he was temperamental and he was Reggie Jackson. But I could get him to talk, and it was a lot of fun to do that. That was like a challenge. The challenge was getting Reggie to talk when the Yankees came to town, and I was able to do that. So Those were people that I really, really enjoyed interviewing.
More episodes of Windy City Sports Talk can be found on Anchor.fm, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Overcast, Pocket Casts, and Radio Public. Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast as well. We now return to Windy City Sports Talk. Near the end of your podcast, you typically ask whoever you're talking to, you know, what, you know, if they weren't a broadcaster, whatever it is they're doing, what would they have potentially have done if they didn't choose to go with the career path they took? And I kind of want to spin that question on you. And why did you choose this? Why did you choose going into broadcasting? And what would have been your second choice?
I had no second choice. This is what I wanted to do when I was 8 years old. So I grew up in the era of Jack Brickhouse, a Hall of Fame broadcaster who basically did everything. I mean, he was known as the voice of the Cubs, but people may not realize who are younger that he was also the voice of the White Sox. He did the Cubs games. He did the White Sox games. He did the Bears games. He did the Bulls games. He did the Sting, which was the soccer team when it first began. Jack Brickhouse is everything. And, you know, when we got our big group of kids together, where I grew up in Albany Park in the city and went to Hilbert Elementary School, and there's this big gravel field, and we would play in the summer. There'd be 20 guys playing baseball. Well, I would be the guy playing second base or right field or wherever, and I would be the announcer. And after the game, I would have my soda can, and I would interview the guys as players. They loved it. We were pretending. And I was pretending to be an announcer then. And it pretty much said to me then, I've got a calling in life. And so really, I didn't have a backup plan. My plan was to follow a dream. And after when I went to Southern Illinois University, that's where I started that dream, because they had a wonderful radio TV school. And within 3 months of being in their department, I became the sports director. And from there, was doing play-by-play and just really having a great time. And so I'm very lucky to have picked the profession that I wanted. And I can say that I'm still following my dream, you know, 8, almost 60 years later.
You were committed early on, and that's awesome.
It seems
like a lot of people that get into media or broadcasting, they always have stories or memories of when they were younger, there was early signs of, hey, this guy likes to talk, or this guy likes to, you know, to be vocal in one way or another. Even I was like that too. I thought about a couple different career options, and I started with writing, actually, with my high school newspaper. But then when it came time for college, I'm like, you know what? I kind of want to do more talking. You know, it's, you know, you only have so much space in your column. So it's like, I want to be that guy that just nonstop talks. So podcasting and radio was perfect for me too. And I didn't do any pretend broadcasting when I was growing up, but though my mom does have me on camera, cause she has she used to take a ton of videos of me. So that's always the great funny, embarrassing moments when company comes over. Hey, let's watch Will on when he was, you know, 4 years old. And there was one time she snuck up on me. I had like a toy phone and I was just going to town talking to some imaginary person. And I wasn't speaking English just yet. I was speaking baby babble, and it's just hilarious. And that's what we credit maybe where I got my inspiration to get in front of a microphone, because I was just a talkative baby and little kid at the time. So
Don't worry about it, Will. There's some of us that are still babbling now. You know,
it's just, true.
It's no longer baby babble. It's adult babble.
Yeah, you're right about that. Well, George, me and you both know that this is an industry where you don't sit in one place for long, whether it's, you know, the station you're at, the role you're in, or even the location. I mean, people travel around to different cities, different states to get going in this,
yep,
this industry. And you seems like you've been able to spend most of your time in, you know, in the same location, a couple different roles, a couple different places, your entire career here in Chicago. Was working in Chicago, being local, always the dream for you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, when I got out of college, I was looking for jobs. I looked for TV jobs. I was offered a job I remember it was a TV station that was on an Indian reservation in North Dakota. And I thought to myself, is this what I really want to do? I don't think so. So a friend of mine got me into radio advertising sales. I hated that. And sports phone came up. And for people who don't know what sports phone is, and those of you younger, you probably don't, it was a telephone sports service that originally began in New York in 1978, and then 1976, and mushroomed to Chicago in the November of 1977. What it was is really for gamblers, in that every 10 minutes we would update scoreboards. I guarantee you, and you know, you make a regular phone call on a regular telephone. I don't think if you probably don't know what a telephone is. Anyhow, people would dial up and it would cost them money. People would say how their parents got really mad at them for the phone bill being so high. Rick Hahn, the general manager of the White Sox, would say, I used to call you all the time, George. I said, really? Yeah, sports phone. You know, the parents didn't like the phone bill. And that place included, our original office included myself, Ron Gleason, who was my boss at WBBM, Les Grobstein, who does overnights at The Score, Fred Huebner, who still does radio at ESPN Chicago, and eventually had people like Jeff Joniak and Luke Kanellis and Chris Bowden and David Schuster and on and on and on. And in New York, there were several famous people that came out there, including the voice of the Mets, Gary Cohn. That's how I first met Gary. Was a great stepping stone for all of us. And so, you know, that spawned into a freelance career. But sports phone, and every time we have some kind of anniversary, and for me, it's when I first started there with Fred in Christmas Eve of 1977, and I put out a picture of sports phone, which you can find on the internet, the responses are insane from so many people who used to call. And we're talking about 43, 44 years ago. And, you know, it lasted. I forgot how long it lasted. Maybe you know, 10, 15 years or something. And it finally went to the wayside. But that was not exactly what I expected my first job to be out of college. But it was a really rewarding one in the end.
And I'll touch on more of that, too, in terms of how your career is broadened and just the transition of again, where broadcasting and radio and everything, where it was when you first started your career and how it's transformed into what it is today. But something that I'm curious to get your thoughts on is during my time at the Illinois Media School, where I had the honor or was lucky enough to have, again, somebody we know, Dan Levy, one of my instructors, who is a mentor for me and has helped me so much along the way. I give him a lot of credit for where I am today with you, with my job at Total Traffic and Weather Network downtown, great guy. But another instructor of mine that really stood out, especially with one of the things he said, is Perry Williams. And one thing that always stuck out to me, and I think this is really true, and I think it does relate to you a little bit too. Perry said that one time during class that he couldn't believe that radio stations didn't hire more local talent, that they always, you know, would outreach across the country and whatnot, and look to grab other big names, which, yes, it does make sense. You know, I get it. It's all about the ratings. But, you know, Perry claimed that the local talent knows the listener best because he knows the culture of the area. He knows the random things that people do appreciate still in terms of the good places to eat, the cool places to visit. But most importantly, especially when it comes to sports talk radio, he knows and feels the pulse of the fan base. And quite frankly, local talent also acts and talks just like those listening. So I agree with Perry on that statement. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, especially you being one of these people, the local kid, the local guy spending your career here. You know, do you agree with that, where you feel like you would be best in your positions because you know how people feel about, even today, how people feel about the Bears, how people feel about the Cubs. Do you think that is vital to a station's success?
It's much more about the history as well. But yes, it's a provincial market. Most of these big cities are pretty much provincial markets. You will get occasionally somebody from the outside that will come in young and be able to make a dent you know, Chuck Swirsky came from, he was born in Washington, Washington State, and came via Columbus and Cleveland, I think, and arrived here. So Chuck was, it was 1979. So Chuck was 25 or 26. And he had to do a talk show, 4 hour a night talk show on WCFL, which is now 1000. And nobody was listening. And yet he made a name for himself. People got used to Chuck. You know, he was able to transform his knowledge of sport and learn enough about Chicago sports to ingrain himself into it. But generally speaking, it's easier because if you've grown up in that city and you're a sports enthusiast and you know your stuff, it's all in you. You've grown with it. And so you can relate that to the listener. I lived that. I know that. You know, look, there are some younger guys in the market today and they're very successful. Into Danny Parkins, for example. And Danny, I think, is, I'm going to take a shot and say he's about 35 now. He grew up here. He did go to Kansas City, but he grew up here. And so he knows the marketplace. And that's the concept of a provincial market. It doesn't make that much of a difference in television. Television was more of looks and glitz, but radio is different. And particularly sports radio. We've had people from outside of marketplace come to town and do other radio gigs and have been successful. Steve Dahl for openers came from Detroit and was incredibly successful with Gary Meyer and then on his own. But when it comes to sports, I mean, that's really, really where you're from is very crucial. Because you know the landscape, and especially when it's a big city like Chicago. I mean, it would be impossible for me to have walked into a New York marketplace in my 20s and know nothing about New York history and try to talk about it. No. And yet, in 1991, late 1991, I was offered a job to do talk radio in Toronto. And part of that was I did know some of the landscape, having worked for this radio station as a freelancer for a number of years. I knew the host, Bob McCowan, and they actually offered me the job. But it was different because it was not only a different city, it was a different country. I didn't know a damn thing about the Grey Cup. That's the week they had me in for an audition. The Grey Cup. Holy crap, I thought you wore that. I didn't know that was a sport, was a championship. What? And I had to fake it, but I did. But I could talk about the Blue Jays and I could talk about the Maple Leafs. And then they offered me the job and I actually turned it down with the hopes. I hadn't been contacted by the Score yet with the hopes that they would hire me. And they actually hired me and Mike Greenberg, I think, on the same day. Which was it couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 days before they actually launched on January 2nd of 1992. So that was a rare situation. I turned down a job in Dallas in 1985 when the late Chet Kopick tried to get me in there after a very famous broadcaster named Frank Glieber had passed away. They wanted somebody to do morning drive and college football. Well, I'm not a football guy. College football, I just didn't follow. So I didn't take the job, you know, and it's tough. It's tough to even consider the idea of going to another marketplace and trying to establish yourself, especially in a big city like Dallas, which already had franchises, established franchises. I may have known about the Dallas Cowboys, but I certainly didn't have that kind of history. But I could talk about the Bears and the Blackhawks and the Bulls and the Cubs and the Sox and anything else, because I grew up here, you know, and that's important. You know, even though, for example, you were born in 1996, you're probably watching sports by 2004 or 5 or whatever it is. So you have that backing. It's part of your blood. You know, you can talk about that part of history to whatever that audience is. So yeah, I don't disagree with Perry that, you know, provincial markets, that they want their own people. They should have their own people.
Well, and I learned about Greenberg starting off at The Score through your podcast. You know, Greeny will be coming up pretty soon. So again, very educational podcast, learning a lot about some of these people where, you know, again, I know I'm like, oh, you know, Mike and Mike in the morning, you know, used to be on my car radio when I would drive to school back in high school and whatnot. So it's kind of cool to learn where these people start. And again, somebody like Greenberg who, you know, yeah, he went to Northwestern, but you know, he started off his career in the city too after school. So, I mean, there's a lot of cool things with that. And I will say I was, you know, I complain about not being around or being able to be old enough to watch the Bulls. Well, I kind of got lucky. And when I really started getting into sports, you know, I had the great, tremendous run that started with the Blackhawks in 2010 mm-hmm. with the first cup. But I mean, I've the one sport I'm confident in, I could tell you and remember players and things that happened even as early as, you know, 2004, 2005 would be the Bears, just because that's, I live in a Bears household and my mom has season tickets. So, I mean, I remember, I have a very, very few like images in my head of what Soldier Field looked like before it got renovated. So, but other than that, you know, my sports knowledge and, you know, me paying attention came relatively later on when I got older, probably 2008, 2009, even the Bulls. I got into the Bulls because of Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah and those guys. So I kind of lucked out with that, but I'm not going to lie, I'm still a little jealous that I didn't get to watch the Bulls, but that's why I love The Last Dance so much and having conversations with, especially somebody like you. It's not like you just watched at home. I mean, you were doing interviews, you were covering, you know, these teams.
We lived it, and it's good for you. Right. Mm-hmm. For me, it was, you know, believe me, there's a lot of revelations there I didn't know, but yes, I lived that and I was a media member, but for somebody like you who didn't, it was a great education to learn about that particular season, about those particular people. So yeah, I think it extended itself not just to people who were old enough to be either fans of it or media members, what have you, but for younger people who weren't born when that happened and they get to learn about it. So yeah, I think The Last Dance was fabulous.
I mean, I'm still starting to feel like I'm getting old now too, though, because it's like, wow, we're really having documentaries come out about that. You know, it feels like the 90s were so far, you know, so long ago, which they're starting to feel that way, but it's crazy.
Yes, Will, this is what happens in life. Each year that goes by, those years seem like they were a long time ago.
Well, honestly, I get it. I'm only 24, so I know people tell me, oh,
I'm
shut up, you're only 24. But it was, so George, you have been, again, we know 47 years in this career, and you've known how this industry has changed in terms of technology and the way, you know, shows are formatted, the way coverage is done. I mean, again, even hearing in your podcast, just the way, you know, how you used to go to events and cover things, even with the recorders and stuff like that. So while you've seen a lot with stories and players and great teams, but in terms of the industry, especially now where you're handling digital audio editing, you're doing a podcast. We've been working from home for the last, it feels like forever, but 11 months with, you know, with the pandemic going on, but being able to work at home and have microphones and stuff like we're doing now. Did you ever imagine a time where back then that we would be where we're at now, where we would develop so much and have everything go digital? And just, I'm curious to get your thoughts on just how you've handled the changes through the industry over the years.
Well, I think social media has been the biggest step after, of course, the internet. I remember, so we had, when we first started at The Score in 92, so I was covering the Cubs, and I'm trying to remember how I got my news. How did we get the newspapers? I forgot how that went. It was, I don't know when we started looking online, you know, and I didn't have a computer with me. I would have to go to the hotel and ask and beg, can I go read the newspapers? And I would do that. I think guys would, you know, read me articles or stuff. I forgot how we did it, but this was the way it was, you know. And before that, we had the teletype machines, which were United Press and Associated Press. And this is how we got all of our news. We got it off of teletype. That's it. That's what you reported. That and any of the phone calls that you made to either sources or interviews you did that you recorded. That's the way this thing worked. And then the internet came, and that changed everything. And then social media came, and then came the biggest and best tool since the teletype machines, Twitter. And I've always told younger people, whatever you do, get on Twitter. And if you're in the sports industry, follow the beat writers, the columnists, the people who are there every day, who may have different stories, but generally speaking, they're there for a reason. They're there to report, even though that's what we were doing for a living. Try to read as many local stuff that you can and whatever national that you can, but follow the people who are big at breaking stories. And that's what's happened today. Because 99 times out of 100, the major people out there, I'm talking about the Schefters and ESPN and the Bob Nightingales and the Rosenthals in baseball and the basketball writers, Orzechowski and the hockey people, when they have a breaking story, they're going to be right. And in the old days, you know, you had two sources before you went on the air. Now, if Bob Nightingale says this is happening, or Ken Rosenthal says this is happening, or Schefter, well, you take it for rote, they're going to be right. And very, very, very rarely have they been wrong. And so Twitter has become an incredible tool for us, because it gives you the immediacy of knowledge. It depends now where you're, and again, when I say knowledge, I'm just talking about our particular industry. It doesn't mean that everybody is always going to be right. I'll give you an example, recent. Now, I put out a tweet about the Bears when it came to Carson Wentz. And what I had gotten was that the Eagles wanted two first-round picks and a third-round pick. And I believe I said two first-round picks and another pick. Now, I knew where I got that from. I was 100% correct, and I was. But then somebody in Philadelphia reported that the Bears are about to get Wentz for, I think it was Tariq Cohen. I think there was a draft choice or two involved. And retweeting that person was a mistake, huge mistake. Didn't know that person. So the positive aspect was I had my story right. That person did not have her story correct. And so unless in that case you absolutely 100% know where you're getting it from is gold, then you've got to be very careful. And I've tweeted tweaks, little pieces of information that I will get. But when it came to that story, I knew exactly where it came from. I knew exactly what the Eagles threw out there or what have you. And that's and people, I must have had 2,500 retweets or not so much retweets, but people glomming onto that story because I said the Bears are listening. And people thought, oh, listening to what? They would be crazy if. Well, of course they would be crazy if. It's what the Eagles first put out there. And what did they get for Carson Wentz? They didn't even get a first-round pick from the Colts. So, but Twitter is it's a very valuable tool in our industry if you are following the right people.
Yeah, and social media is actually very important, because not only, you know, you got these people today, like Adam Schefter. I mean, he's made a career, made a name for himself with being, you know, up to date, just, you know, as quickly as possible.
And right.
And right, yeah, it's not only, being first, it's about being accurate too.
Being accurate,
And even if you're not in the reporting aspect, even for you and I with our podcast here, like, what am I going to, you know, how are we sharing the podcast? How are we getting, you know, it out there other than, you know, having conversations, texting people, talking to our family and friends? I mean, we're trying to get it out there to the masses. So it's, you know, social media is so important in multiple ways in terms of when it comes to media and content creation. So it's, you know, I've always had the view social media is a great tool. It's people that, in my opinion, are the ones that kind of ruin it or give it a bad name. But ultimately, social media is a great tool for many things, but especially in our industry and with podcasting and getting your information out there. Now, George, before we wrap up, you kind of previewed a little bit of what I wanted to end with, because this wouldn't be Windy City Sports Talk if I didn't bring up the Bears or you know, a Chicago team up at least once, especially the Bears. I'm sure people are eager to hear me rant and rave again about the Bears, because I feel like there's nothing ever good to talk positive with them because it's always frustration. But speaking of this Bears quarterback situation, with a lot of it revolving around Carson Wentz here, especially in the last couple of weeks. Okay, so Wentz ends up getting traded to, you know, the Colts yesterday. And yeah, you're right. It wasn't a first round pick. They did get a third round pick. However, that can, there's a, the other pick.
Conditional pick. Yeah.
Conditional. So, but if you're the Colts, you could live if that second round pick turns into a first. That's if Wentz plays in 75% of the snaps. So if he does happen to suck, or if he gets hurt, then it's no loss. And it's kind of a win-win. You may lose the pick, but if he plays really well and leads him to the playoffs and recovers, I think he's going to be just fine. And I'm glad the Bears didn't get Wentz, because I've been talking to people about this. I have a lot of friends from college that are Colts fans, you know, going to Ball State, where it's Colts and Pacers kingdom out there. I was telling them, like, look, don't be too worried about having Wentz, because not only did you not give up a lot, but at the end of the day, Wentz makes more sense in Indy compared to the Bears, because even though Wentz is struggling, they have their offense set. They have their players. They have good coaching staff. They have a good playbook. If he was to come to Chicago where there's no identity, there's no offensive identity and too many question marks, I think it would have been a little bit too risky, unless if the Eagles were to release him. And if he was to become a free agent, then I would have considered maybe bringing him in. But I think it was the right choice to avoid Carson Wentz. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, especially since you've been following.
I totally agree with that. I don't know why they want. He had a terrible year, and he's right now, he's a broken down quarterback. I'm not sure why you'd want to invest in a broken down quarterback who's got, you know, $44 million coming in salary. You know, that said, this regime has really screwed it up when it comes to quarterbacks. You go out and you get Mike Glennon, who was abysmal. You draft Trubisky, which I don't think we have to belabor the issue that he was the wrong choice. And then Nick Foles, who looks spectacular in a game against Atlanta. And then you realize that he's hot and cold, and mostly cold. Problem the Bears have is they just haven't been able to identify that position. Though I will say they did when Jerry Angelo traded two first round picks for Jay Cutler. And Jay Cutler was a franchise quarterback. He was with Denver. He had his flaws, not so much football, but his personality. And that may have transcended into the locker room. But I think that if Jay Cutler would have been given a much better offensive line, because as you recall, he was killed. This is a guy who kept getting up after getting sacked numerous times, viciously, I might add. He didn't have wide receivers. I mean, Lovie Smith tried to make Devin Hester his number one wide receiver. You can already see where that was going. And then he had seven offensive coordinators in 10 years. If Cutler would have had the right people, I think the results would have been better. And if not for an injury against Green Bay, the Bears could have made that Super Bowl that year. And people knocked this guy for being injured in a crucial game, but I mean, physically, he was almost impossible to knock out of a game. Other than that, I mean, this is a franchise that historically just has not ever picked the right guy. Even Jim McMahon was okay. He was a galvanizing figure when they won the Super Bowl, but he didn't throw many touchdown passes that year. Didn't have to. He had Walter Payton. Now the Bears are in a tough spot. You don't have the draft capital to go out and make a move to trade up in the draft. And we're not talking about Watson because you're not going to be able to get him because you don't have the draft capital. But even some of the other quarterbacks who are out there and available, monetarily, you're in a tough spot with your salary cap, and you still absolutely have to re-sign Allen Robinson or put the tag on him this year and try to negotiate a deal. Because he's not only your best receiver, he is one of the league's better receivers. He happens to be on your team. What he needs is a guy to throw him the ball more often. They actually need more than one wide receiver. They need a couple more. So they have a lot of issues. And all of that revolves around the quarterback. And I don't see right now how they can resolve the issue next season. You are not bringing back Trubisky. That ship has sailed. So who are you going to get? Derek Carr? If he's available, he's going to cost you a first-round pick, maybe more. Well, guess what? You have an aging defense. This whole thing was built around a defense in which, and in the first year, remember, they went 12-4 with Trubisky, and then had it not been for the double doink, who knows where they would have gone. It's kind of like Derrick Rose. Who knows where the Bulls would have gone had he not injured his knee. But then things leveled off, and you could see that Trubisky was nothing more than mediocre at best, and that's really what he's going to be. So where are you going to get a quarterback? Yeah, Sam Darnold? His ceiling, to me, is higher than Trubisky. But what are you going to trade for him? What are you going to do? They may be forced to bridge for the year and see what happens after the season. But when you screw up the quarterback situation, which is what Ryan Pace did, it sets your franchise back a decade. And that's what's going to happen now, because if a franchise quarterback walked in the door tomorrow, they might get lucky, but that defense is not getting younger. And you've had some people who had down years last year. So Jackson has to have a real good year. Golden has to come back. Robert Quinn, he has to earn his money somehow. And then you have to have a legitimately decent quarterback, at least for the year. You don't need a superstar, but you need a legitimately decent quarterback. Well, they don't have one right now. And to be honest with you, Will, I'm just not sure where or how they're going to get one. They're committed to get one, but ooh.
Yeah, exactly, George. And I mean, you bring up so many great points. It's like, look, Jim McMahon, the reason why he celebrated so much in Chicago is because he won a Super Bowl and because of his personality in terms of being where he ranks as the all-time great quarterbacks with the Bears. Unfortunately, he's still up there because they haven't had many. The fact that it's like it's Jay Cutler, Jim McMahon, and then you go all the way back to arguably the best Bears quarterback, Sid Luckman, who played in like the 40s. So
I'll interrupt you for a moment. The guy who holds the single season record for passing yards and touchdowns is Eric Kramer. And had Eric Kramer not broken his neck in 1996, Dave Wannstedt may have had a pretty damn good team that year. He was a really, really good quarterback. I mean, he was definitely above average, not a franchise quarterback, but definitely above average. And yes, when your franchise, when its greatest quarterback was a quarterback that was around long before I was born, then you know you've got a franchise that just hasn't been able to solve the age-old problem of having the most important player on your team. quarterback.
Well, hey, at least we could relate with one thing. At least we both don't remember Sid Luckman playing.
Yeah, that's true. So, good point.
So at least we have that in common. Yeah, at least we have that in common. But I just wanted to say quickly, though, too, like I think it was the Robert Quinn signing was the most Bears thing to do last year in the offseason. You talked about how they should have got another wide receiver, even though they had Allen Robinson. A guy I was pushing for was Robbie Anderson, who was with the Jets for a couple of years, started his career with the Jets, kind of quiet, you know, not a big name receiver, but he put up some big statistics. He was a free agent last year, didn't get a whole lot of suitors, not a guy you had to pay a ton of money for, definitely not $75 million like Robert Quinn. I believe he went to Carolina for, I believe, $20 million. So that would have been a guy to be a perfect number two, number three receiver to throw in there with Allen Robinson and, of course, you know, Anthony Miller and some of the other guys. But it's such a Bears thing to do that they have this pride and this sense of we're the monsters of the Midway. We always have to build the defense. You know, that's why they went and got Khalil Mack, which I to this day, I still think it was a pretty good trade. I just wish he would have performed. His 2018 performance would have carried into 2019 and 2020. But I just feel like it's such a Bears thing to do where instead of getting help on that offense, even with rolling with Trubisky and Foles last year, it's the fact that they went and spent money on another guy for $75 million who totaled maybe got a total of 2 sacks, 1.5 sacks this year. And that was an off year for Robert Quinn. We know his career and the last couple of teams he's been with, he's been a guy that could get you 10 sacks without a problem. But doesn't it just seem like a typical Bears thing to do to always go over and prefer defense over offense?
Well, I think that they were certainly, I think they figured that Eddie Goldman was going to play, and he is, you know, Eddie Goldman is a very important part of that defense. And then if it's healthy with Akeem Hicks, you know, and Danny Trevathan, if people play up to their potential, they've got a very good defense. Again, some of it's getting older, but I understood why they did that. I understood that they figured if we can stay in the game with our defense, we might be able to score enough points. Well, they did score more points this year. Of course, they did play some teams where they could pile up some points. But when you look at the teams that were the final four of the NFL this year, look at their quarterbacks. And Buffalo's quarterback is on the way up. The other three guys are Hall of Famers. But the reason New England Patriots, everybody does that, by the way. The reason the Tampa Bay Buccaneers won that Super Bowl was their defense. Their defense won that Super Bowl. They stopped, albeit an injured Patrick Mahomes and an offensive line that was completely crippled. I mean, they still have Brady. That's important. And there was Mahomes on the other side. And you need quarterbacks like that to get you to where you want to go, which is the Super Bowl. And if you don't have that, unless you have a competent quarterback who has the tools, albeit those tools are a good offensive line and good receivers, you wind up being 8-8. That's what happens. And I'd like to say there's light at the end of the tunnel for the Bears, but right now I still see darkness, and that's because they just don't have a QB.
You're absolutely right. George, before, as we wrap up here, my prediction is Foles is going to be their veteran that potentially plays this year. And I think they're just going to end up at this point sticking with drafting someone. Maybe the Ryan Pace trade that comes around, maybe it's him moving up in the draft. The ESPN mock guys are saying that they're going to trade with the 49ers again and select Mac Jones from Alabama. I'm kind of leaning towards that's probably in terms of my predictions. I always love to do predictions, even if I'm wrong 95% of the time. But at the end of the day, I think at this point, it's going to be Foles as your veteran, and they're just going to draft somebody and trade up in the draft. That's going to be the Ryan Pace trade of this offseason, is going to be moving up in the draft for a quarterback. And to end today, I'm just curious, what if you had to make a prediction, what do you think the quarterback situation looks like heading into the season?
I have no idea. Honestly, I don't. They were interested in Wentz. They never really made the offer. I don't have a clue as to what they're going to wind up doing. I wish I did. I can only predict that if they were to get Sam Darnold without giving up the farm, he might be the type of reclamation project that will help them. Again, this is something in which you have to be very leery of what you give up, but I can't, I wish I could sit here and I had a crystal ball and tell you this is what they're going to do, but I have no idea what they're going to do.
Yeah, it's going to be a long off season, definitely full of probably surprising and intriguing things. But it's probably, like you said, there's probably not going to be a light at the end of the tunnel. They're going to be sitting in darkness because they can't, again, as always, the story of the franchise, they just can't seem to figure out the most important position of the game, and that's quarterback. Well, George, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And also thank you for the opportunity to work with you on your podcast, not only giving me an opportunity to work on my craft, but also, you know, learn a lot from you, from, you know, working with you and listening to your podcast and how you conduct your business in the industry. So I thank you for all of that. I do appreciate it.
Well, you're most welcome, Will, and keep working hard because I need you.
Of course. I'm going to be waiting for your next phone call next week on what we have to edit next. So, well, thanks again, George. I thank you to everybody for listening, and be sure to check out George's podcast, Tell Me a Story I Don't Know. You can essentially find it everywhere you find this podcast, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the TuneIn app. And of course, be sure to like and subscribe to his podcast. Leave a 5-star review again on Apple Podcasts, 5-star reviews across the board, and also a lot of great comments and praise that George is getting for his tremendous work. So, and again, of course, you could find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many others as well. So until next time, be well. Thanks for listening to Windy City Sports Talk. To find more great episodes, be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast on Anchor.fm, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Pocket Casts, Overcast, and Radio Public. Thanks again for listening, and be well.